The Camerata Baraloque played a cantilena and finale by Huastavino.
This is WHFR Dearborn, beautiful classical programming presented to you each and every day right here on our non-commercial independent station, WHFR. We've got so many other exciting activities and events that we'd love to share with you. We would welcome you to become part of our WHFR loyal listener group. Simply give me a call, Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, at 313-845-9842, and I will be happy to put you on our free WHFR mailing list. Again, the telephone number is 313-845-9842. If you have comments, suggestions, requests, and anything of that nature, additionally, you might like to call me and let's chat about it. We're always open to new ideas and love to hear feedback of what you're enjoying here at WHFR and also ways that we might improve to bring this beautiful music your way. So don't hesitate to call me today. Love to hear from you, and we're very thankful that you're a part of our WHFR loyal listeners.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College.
Basic Concepts of Music, an audio print series funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. Your host for this program on the concepts of form is Professor J. Peter Burkholder.
A drowsy reverie. Interrupted by nervous thrills. Many music lovers hear music, but are not certain how to listen to music. If you have no idea of the form or shape of a piece of music, you probably will hear it, as the philosopher George Santayana put it, in a drowsy reverie interrupted by nervous thrills. The music is from The Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi. I'm Peter Burkholder, and our topic is musical form. It is part of human nature to find form and shape in what we see and hear. We want to know what makes the world tick. In music, we want to follow where the music is going so that we don't get lost and end up in, well, in a drowsy reverie. In this program, we'll be searching for general principles that you can follow in any music. We'll find out how beginnings, middles, and endings give shape to music. And we'll learn basic terms that you can use to talk about musical form. That's a nice short musical phrase. Now, what happens next? Okay, same music. Then what? Same music again. This is the most basic and most common musical form. You take a musical idea, you repeat it over and over, as this song does. But that's just the refrain of the song. Let's consider the form of the whole song. What happens after the refrain, when the verse comes around? Here, there's another basic principle of musical form at work. Listen. The verse now has a different musical idea, a different melody. the principle of contrast. You can hear two ideas of equal importance, and they alternate. Verse, refrain, verse again, back to the refrain, then the verse, refrain, and so on until the singer decides to end it, 2 or 10 or 20 verses later. Now, let's go back to the piece we started with, The Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi, and see how Vivaldi uses repetition and contrast to give his music shape. Here's a little musical idea that we hear again and again in the first movement of the Spring Concerto. When Vivaldi first presents this idea, he repeats it right away. He wants to make sure you remember it. We'll hear that little idea again and again, like a refrain. In the music of Vivaldi's time and place, Italy in the early 18th century, we call this kind of musical idea a ritornello, a little something that returns. But instead of hearing the same music between each refrain and the next, as in the Russian folk song we just heard, we hear different music each time. So we have both repetition and contrast, one repeating musical idea with a lot of contrasting musical ideas in between. This piece is about spring, and Vivaldi has provided a poem to help us follow the images in the music. Spring has come. Spring has come, the ritornello says. And joyfully the birds greet her with merry songs. Hear the birds? Spring has come. And brooks flow with sweet murmurings, blown by the breezes. Spring has come, but now come thunder and lightning, covering the sky with a black cloak. Spring has come. And as the storm quiets, the tiny birds turn again to their enchanting song. And so the images flow by. The idea is very simple. One repeating musical idea alternating with other contrasting ideas. That lets Vivaldi show us many sides of spring, from twittering birds to April showers. Now, the way I've described it so far, this could go on forever. But it doesn't. How does Vivaldi let us know that the movement is over? Ah, this part is pretty clever. It's another simple idea that we find in many, many pieces of music. At the beginning of the piece, as we hear the orchestra play "Spring Has Come" for the first time, we get a strong sense of the key. This is the home key, the tonic. The second time we hear the ritornello, we're still in the same key. Then Vivaldi starts moving around. He leaves the home key, or tonic, the key we started in, and wanders off to other keys. Here's the third ritornello in a new key. And here's the next one, and yet another new key. In fact, now it's in a minor key when it's always been in a major key before. Let's hear these three keys close together so you can really hear the difference. First, the starting key, the home key or tonic, a new key, and yet another new key. We may not know exactly what key we are in, and for now that's not really important. But we will probably get a feeling of being someplace else than where we started, as if we set out from home and have gone off walking in the woods, looking at the birds and the brooks and the weather. At the end, Vivaldi gets us back to the home key, and he plays the little refrain twice to make sure we notice that we have come home and the piece is about to end. Can there be repetition and contrast going on at the same time? Of course. That's the technique we call variation. One simple way to combine repetition and contrast is to have one part repeat a musical idea while the other parts add something new. In the Canon by Johann Pachelbel, there's a simple repeated idea in the bass, the lowest part of the texture. The other instruments add something new each time the bass repeats, as here. And here. And here again. The form of this piece may be called variations over a repeating bass. The repeating figure in the bass is often called a ground or ground bass because it provides a foundation or ground on which the piece is built. Another way to combine repetition and contrast is through melodic variation. A very common form in music of many times and countries is the set of variations on a given theme. Beethoven wrote a set of variations on the British national anthem, God Save the King, known in the U.S. as My Country, 'Tis of Thee. First, we hear the theme. The first variation, decorating the tune by adding new notes and varying the harmony and the rhythm. Shapes the tune into a quickly running line. Mm-hmm. And so it goes, each variation presenting the tune in a new guise. This is called variation form, or theme and variations. But the idea of variation itself also happens in other forms. It is as basic a building block of musical form as our repetition and contrast. Variation, repetition, and contrast. With some practice, you can unlock almost any musical form with these three keys. But these are not all there is to musical form. I talked a bit earlier about how we know when a piece is over or when the end is near. This is another aspect of musical form, an even more basic aspect than repetition, contrast, and variation. Music is like a language. We hear it, and it makes sense to us. One of the ways music is most like language is that there is a logical and necessary order to it. You begin at the beginning, and you end at the end. Imagine telling a story backwards, or reciting a sentence backwards, or mixing up the words in a random order. It wouldn't make any sense. Just like a story or a sentence, music gives us cues. This is the beginning, this is the end, this is somewhere in the middle. You start a speech or a story with a beginning, like this. Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Or, once upon a time, in a land far away. The same thing with music. You start a piece of music with a beginning. No matter what style or form, the music will say, this is the beginning. At the beginning of their song, Revolution, the Beatles make sure they have our full attention. Yo, they say, listen up. And then they start telling us what's on their mind. Johannes Brahms begins this movement of his German Requiem with a gentle introduction before the chorus begins to sing. It's the same idea as the Beatles, getting our attention and leading into the main event, but the mood is a little more relaxed. Beethoven's Eighth Symphony, on the other hand, gets right down to business with the first theme. Whatever form, whatever style, there's a way of catching the listener's ear and saying, come along, we're setting out on a journey together. When the trip is over, the music lets us know. Here's the Beatles again. All right. All right. All right. All right. The last two chords let us know it's over, but we're already prepared for them when they come, because we keep hearing the same idea over and over. All right. All right. We get the same sort of effect at the end of the first movement of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. Now, the middle of a piece is rather special. It's no longer the beginning, but it's not the ending yet either. So it's important for the composer to keep us up in the air with something that keeps us moving forward. Brahms, for instance, has several things going on at once, overlapping with each other, so that we never come to rest. Thank you. In the middle of the first movement of his Eighth Symphony, Beethoven keeps repeating the same idea over and over, moving it around from key to key. Again, there's a sense of never coming to a rest, but always moving forward. This wouldn't make a good ending or a good beginning, but it makes a great middle. Very exciting, like a fight scene in a movie. We can recognize the sense of beginning something, ending something, or being in the middle over the course of an entire song or piece, but we can also hear it in a very small phrase.
You say you want a revolution.
In the Beatles song Revolution, for instance, we can hear the end of the first phrase, and then the start of the next one.
You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know.
And then the end of that phrase.
We all want to change.
And the start of the last phrase.
But when you talk about destruction, don't you
then
know
we hear the end of the whole verse
out.
And the start of the refrain.
You know it's gonna be all right. All right.
Finally, we hear the end of the refrain. And it starts all over again. With the beginning of the next verse.
Well, you know.
Think again of a story. Within the story, there are parts of the story, episodes in a longer tale. Each part is made up of paragraphs, each paragraph of several sentences, and some of the sentences have many phrases in them. The story has an end and a beginning and a middle, but so does each episode, each paragraph, each sentence, and each phrase. We can feel as we listen that a sentence or an episode is ending and another beginning, and we know the whole story isn't over yet. The same thing happens in music. In the Beatles song, for instance, we can hear that the phrase is over, but the verse isn't over yet. Then we hear that the verse is over, but we know the refrain is still coming. Then we hear that the refrain is over, but we know there are more verses to come, until we finally hear that little tale or coda at the end that lets us know the piece is done, finished, no more. That's all, folks. The point is that some endings are more emphatic than others. Just like the end of a sentence marked with a period is more final than the end of a phrase marked with a comma. Almost every piece of music, whatever its form, is shaped by repetition, contrast, and variation, by beginnings, middles, and ends, and by a sense that some endings are more final, more emphatic than others. We can hear a piece of music we have never heard in an unfamiliar form, and we can understand it right away because we recognize beginnings and ends, repetition and contrast. We don't even have to think about it. It's as natural as telling a story. But what about something really unfamiliar? Well, certainly, some pieces of music will be more difficult to follow than others, but most will have some clues. Here's a section from the second part of Igor Stravinsky's ballet, The Rite of Spring. This is the section called Glorification of the Chosen One. Listen for things that repeat. Listen for things that contrast. Listen for variations. Listen for a sense of going off to the woods and coming back home at the end. For simplicity's sake, I'm going to give a letter to each new idea we hear, so you can follow all the repetitions and variations and hear all the contrasts. Now, how's this for a beginning? A, B, A, three times. Varied. C. C. A. And C. D. A. D. A. Four times. And varied. And off to the woods. E. E repeats. Varied. E again. F. For contrast. E. F again. Repeated. G. G again. G again. H. A bridge. And back to the first section. A. A. B. A. D. A. D. A. Four times and vary. End. Lots of things repeat here. Lots of things are introduced for contrast. There's a good deal of variation. There's also an overall shape of first section contrasting middle section and final section that's like the first. So it's a ternary or three-part form, ABA. What about that ending? Isn't that kind of abrupt? Well, yes. Isn't that the point? Everything about this music is abrupt and unexpected. When a new idea is introduced, it starts and everything else stops. Then it stops and we go back to what we were doing before or on to something new. Same thing with this ending. It just stops. Stravinsky knows that we expect to be prepared for an ending, and he plays on that expectation by doing something different. What could be more dramatic than an unexpected ending? You can use the ideas we have talked about for listening to any piece of music and making sense out of how it is shaped. Now you can be aware of what you have been doing all along when you listen to music. Hearing familiar things repeat, hearing new things when they appear, hearing variations, hearing things begin, continue, and come to a close. You have been doing these things all your life as you listen to music, hearing the patterns, following the shapes. Now you have the words to talk about them, too.
This program on form in the series Basic Concepts of Music was written by Dr. Carl Signell and J. Peter Burkholder, produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn. The faculty host was Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University, project director and script editor, Linda Clauder. This audio print course was developed by the University of Wisconsin Extension through Wisconsin Public Radio, the Independent Study Program, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with funds from the Annenberg CPB Project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications. Basic Concepts of Music, an audio print series funded by the Annenberg CPB Project. Professor J. Peter Burkholder is your host for this program titled Interactions.
In this series, we've looked at music from many angles, focusing first on rhythm, then on melody, on harmony, and on the elements of form. And we've listened to music from many different nations, all types of music. Now, in this program, let's see how all of these factors can work together. How do rhythm, melody, harmony, and form work together in creating a piece of music? How can we use what we know to follow long and complicated pieces of music? Let's start with a simple example of how rhythm, melody, harmony, and the elements of form interact. Imagine that you're writing a phrase of music, and you want to give it a definite shape, with a beginning, a middle, and an end. That is, you want to give it some form. Can you do that with harmony? Sure. How's this? Beginning, middle, end. We can give our music shape by using the three primary chords in any key. That is the tonic, the dominant, and the subdominant. The tonic, or one chord, is home plate, where we start from and where we return to at the end. That can be our beginning and our end. Usually at the end, just before the tonic, we hear the dominant or five chord, and the motion from dominant to tonic or from five to one is what signals the end. That's enough to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, just tonic, dominant, and tonic chords. But we can make the middle a little longer by adding a subdominant or four chord between the opening tonic and the dominant. Now we have a little musical sentence, which gets its shape from the harmony. Beginning, middle, and end. What about melody? Can we give a shape to a musical phrase just through the melody? Sure. How's this? We start on the tonic note, the first note of the scale, and we drop down below it. That will be our beginning. To make an end, let's go back to where we started and use the leading tone to point us strongly back to home base. Now, to make a middle, let's just repeat our second note and then add them all together. That already has a shape: beginning, middle, and end. But again, let's stretch the middle out just a bit to give it more variety. Beginning, middle, and end. So we can give a phrase shape through harmony or through melody. What about rhythm? You bet. There, the strong beats signal the beginning and the end, and the weak beats carry us through the middle. Once again, though, we could make the middle a little more interesting. Beginning, middle, and end. You know, that sounds familiar. Put it together with the melody we had before. And with the harmony we started with. The point is that even this little phrase has a shape. Beginning, middle, and end. And that shape is created by the harmony, by the melody, and by the rhythm. Each is strong enough to give it the shape independently, but together, the sense of shape is even stronger, as the rhythm helps give shape to the melody helps give definition to the rhythm, and the harmony makes the ending even more emphatic than it would be otherwise. What does this example teach us? First, that rhythm, melody, and harmony are each strong enough to give music shape all by themselves. For you can get the sense of beginning a gesture, continuing it, and coming to a close with any one of them alone. But it also teaches us that these three elements can work together, each supporting the others. They reinforce each other, and that makes the shape of a phrase even more clear. We can see the same process working in much larger and longer pieces of music. Let's take a look at a piece by Joseph Haydn to see how this works. Haydn creates a little dance for string quartet, that is, two violins, a viola, and a cello, out of a very short and simple idea. This is the idea. Three chords. One, five, one. Tonic, dominant, tonic. Let's give these three chords a little more flesh by adding a more definite rhythm in triple time and a cheerful little melody. Haydn gives it to the cello with the violins and viola playing accompaniment. Now we have a complete phrase. How do we make our piece longer? Well, we could repeat this phrase. ¶¶ But then both endings are equally emphatic. What a dull story. I bought a chair. I bought a chair. Big deal, you bought a chair. Why tell us twice? But I went to town and bought a chair. That's more interesting. Instead of playing the same phrase twice, let's vary the first time to make the phrase end a little up in the air. Let's keep the cello melody moving forward in a steady rhythm, and save the more definite ending for the end of the second phrase. First phrase, end. Second phrase, end. Now that makes sense. We've expanded a simple phrase by repetition and variation. Putting two phrases together like this makes a musical sentence, a complete thought, which we call a period, like the period that comes at the end of a sentence. Now, we can expand this period in the same way we expanded what we started with to a phrase, and the phrase to a period, that is, by adding things in the middle. We can make two periods out of our two phrases. The first phrase makes a good beginning, so let's add a new second phrase, one that doesn't sound so final. And the final phrase makes a good ending. So let's pair it with a new first phrase, with a different musical idea, to provide a little contrast. Now, what happens when we put these two periods together? Does it make sense? You bet it makes sense. Now, one important reason the end of the second period sounds more final than the end of the first period is the harmony. You remember the basic idea we started with? 1-5-1? Well, the first period begins on 1 and ends on 5, and the second period begins on 5 and ends back on 1. Think of 1-5-5-1. Here are the beginnings and ends of the two periods. The first begins on the tonic, and ends on the dominant. And the second begins on the dominant, and ends back on the tonic. So that little idea we started with, 1-5-1, tonic, dominant, tonic, beginning, middle, end, has been stretched out into a much longer piece. The first period takes us from 1 to 5, or from the beginning to the middle, and the second period takes us back home, from the middle to the end, from 5 back to 1. So now let's hear the whole thing again. Beginning at home on 1, going off to 5 in the middle, and back home to 1 at the end. Haydn asks for each of the two periods to be repeated. This makes a binary form, or two-part form, in which there are two parts, each one repeated, the first one going from the tonic to another chord or key, and the second part coming back home to the tonic. Let's hear the whole thing with the repeats. Here's the first part. First part ends. First part repeats. And it ends. Second part begins. And it ends. Repeat second part. And it ends. What we've done here on a very small scale is to take apart and put back together a complete form, as composed by Haydn. This could be a complete piece in itself, but it's rather short. What Haydn does is expand binary form in several different ways in order to create longer forms. And then he groups several of these together as movements of still longer works called sonatas, symphonies, or string quartets. Let's look at how he does this in his string quartet in D major, opus 20, number 4. He uses the little piece we have been hearing as the middle part, or trio, of a three-part or ternary form. The idea is very simple. He just pairs this piece with another binary form, a dance in triple meter and moderate tempo called a minuet. We hear the minuet first, then the trio, then the minuet again. The minuet and trio have the same binary form, but they are strongly contrasting in rhythm, melody, and harmony. Here's the minuet. First part begins. First part ends. First part repeats. And it ends. Second part begins. Second part repeats. And it ends. On to the trio. First part. Repeat first part. Second part. Repeat second part. And back to the minuet. Second part of minuet. That's the minuet and trio, the third movement of Haydn's quartet. In the second movement of the same quartet, Haydn takes a binary form and expands it in a different way, by using it as a theme for a series of variations. In the first and last movements of this quartet, Haydn uses yet another way of expanding binary form, by making each of the two parts of the binary form much longer. This expanded binary form becomes what is called sonata form. Sonata form is one of the most sophisticated of musical forms, and it's hard to talk about it without getting very technical. But what's important is not the details, but just this, that even this very sophisticated form is based on the same simple concepts of rhythm, melody, harmony, and form that we have encountered in other music. Let's take the last movement of the Haydn string quartet as an example. The overall shape is just like that of the trio. Two parts, each repeated, the first going from the tonic to the dominant, and the second returning to the tonic. What is different from the trio is that each of the two parts is so long, almost a minute and a half, as long as the complete minuet and trio together. How can we follow it? Well, Haydn is giving us cues all along the way, through the rhythm, melody, and harmony. He marks the opening tonic with a theme, a complete period with two contrasting phrases and a clear beginning and end. The harmony is stable and in the tonic, the melody is clear, the rhythm and phrasing are regular and predictable. Here's the first phrase. And it ends. The second contrasting phrase begins. And it ends on the dominant. This is a complete period. If this were a short binary form, as short as the trio, that might be the whole first part. We might hear this period repeat and then go on to the second part. And at first it sounds like that's what's going to happen. But But instead of a simple repetition, the rhythm, melody, and harmony take us off in a new direction. We keep going, but where? The harmony wanders, the rhythm is unpredictable, first running forward, and then halting. The melody breaks up into little fragments. After many detours, we arrive at a new key, the dominant. Haydn marks our arrival at this new key with a new idea. The harmony is stable again, and in the dominant, the melody and rhythm clear. Now we're near the end of part one, and Haydn hammers home the dominant key with some closing material, we might call it a closing theme, that really lets us know this first part is over. It's over. It's really over. And back to the beginning. That's just the first part of this long binary form. But throughout this first part, we always know where we are, because Haydn gives us cues. He marks the beginning with a theme in the home key or tonic. He marks the new key with another theme and adds some closing material to let us know the first part is almost over. And just as we've heard in the case of the trio, how he can expand things in the middle to make a short idea into a whole piece, so here he expands things in the middle too by inserting a long transition between the two themes. So this is the order of events. The first theme in the tonic, a transition where the music seems to be unsettled until it finally comes to a resting place, a second theme in the new key of the dominant, and some closing material, or a closing theme. Now let's hear the repetition of this first part and use the terms for these different subparts to help us follow the progress of the music. The first theme. The transition begins. Still in the transition. Where are we going? The second theme on the dominant. Now the closing material. And the first part is over. And we hear the second part begin. In the second part, we travel back to the tonic. It takes us a while to get there, as we wander rapidly through the keys, hearing rhythms and melodies we have heard before in new variations. When we do get back to the home key, Haydn really lets us know. In fact, he gives us the most obvious cue possible by playing virtually the entire first part again, but all on the tonic. This creates a nice balance between the first and second parts of this movement. Everything we hear in the first part, we hear again at the end of the second part. Here's the first theme again. The closing material, early. Haydn's having a little fun here. Now the transition, the harmony wanders around. Back to the tonic, the second theme, only this time it's in the tonic key. Now the closing material. And the second part repeats. So we see that the form Haydn uses in the first and last movements of this quartet is an expanded binary form. Haydn would have called this first movement form, since in his time, in the late 18th century, it was the form most composers used for the first movements, and often for the last movements, in their symphonies, string quartets, and sonatas. Nowadays, we call this sonata form. The first part of sonata form is called the exposition. That's the part in which we hear the first theme, the transition to a new key, the second theme, and the closing material. At the end of the second part, there's a restatement of all or most of the material from the exposition, but this time it all stays in the tonic key. This restatement of the original material is called the recapitulation. But before the recapitulation comes the development, where the music wanders from key to key before coming back home to the tonic. So the first part of this greatly expanded binary form is the exposition. The second part includes both the development and the recapitulation. And speaking of recapitulation, look how far we've come. From shaven a haircut to sonata form, one of the most elaborate and widely used forms in all of music. And all along the way, we observed composers using the basic tools of rhythm, melody, and harmony, using them together to give music shape and form. And now, before we close, let's take a quick look at how sonata form blossomed a generation after Haydn in the symphonies of Beethoven. Beethoven's movements in sonata form can be quite long and dramatic, but they are often just as easy to follow as Haydn's, because once again they use the same mix of elements. Take the first movement of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. Like the Haydn, it begins with a first theme in the tonic key in clear phrases. Now the transition begins. The harmony seems to get stuck. But we come out of it all right, and here's the second theme. After the second theme, we get closing material, and the exposition repeats. Then the second section begins with the development. Just as in the Haydn, we hear the harmony wandering around from key to key, the rhythm unpredictable, the melody fragmented and bouncing from one instrument to another. The opening material at the recapitulation is the dramatic climax of the movement. Now, Beethoven almost never has the second part repeat because he's thinking of sonata form in dramatic terms. Once we've gone through a long and stormy development section and a climactic recapitulation, there is just no reason to go back and hear it all over again. At the end of the recapitulation, it sounds as if Beethoven is going to repeat the development section, but instead, he wanders in new directions. This is a long ending called a coda, from the Italian word for tale, and it leads to a glorious ending to the movement. We've talked about rhythm, melody, harmony, and form, but these basic elements are not everything that goes into this music, and alone they don't really explain the unique power of this music. To do that, we need to talk about timbre, about texture, about the emotion and meaning that music can convey, about the connections between music and words and dance and theater, about the different styles of music. And these are the topics that we turn to in our next several programs in this series.
Interactions, a program in the series Basic Concepts of Music, written and hosted by Professor J. Peter Burkholder of Indiana University, produced by Ralph Johnson, with technical production by Marv Nunn, project director and script editor Linda Clauder, studio performance by the ProArty Quartet. This audio print course was developed by the University of Wisconsin Extension, through Wisconsin Public Radio, the Independent Study Program, and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with funds from the Annenberg CPB Project, providing opportunities for higher education through telecommunications.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. Good morning. My name is Bill Keith. It's time for Light from the Underground. It's a pleasure to be here with you this cold, cold November morning. Hope your day is off to a great start, and we've got great music to kind of ease you into the afternoon. We'll get things started with some brand new music from Kate Campbell. This is the title track from her album, Save the Day.
What's it gonna take to save the day? What you gonna need to feel okay? If you close your eyes, what would you pray? What's it gonna take to save the day? I had a friend who spent his life trying to win the lottery. He just knew that $1 million would put an end to his misery. Today. For some people it's a brand new car, for some it's just a parking space. A little water in the desert sun, or champagne by the case. A big mansion in the Hamptons, or a warm place to sleep tonight. What's it gonna take to save the day? What you gonna need to feel okay? If you close your eyes, what would you?
You should see me stop and scan the hot sky.